You are listening to Anamkara, a podcast about the spiritual journey and what makes us human. Anamkara is a soul friend, a person with whom you can share your deepest thoughts, feelings, and dreams with. In this podcast, I will share my journey as well as occasionally have guests from myriad different religions and walks of life. And for a time, we walk together and learn from each other's journey. So come along with us and be an Anamkara, a soul friend.
Rochelle E. Goodrich is quoted as saying, "We forget that the sweetest joys are found in the simplest acts. Hugs, laughter, quiet observation, basic movements, holding hands, pleasant music, shared stories, a listening ear, an unhurried visit, and selfless service. It is sad we forget a truth so elementary." My guest today is Ethan Walker III, who, when I first saw him on our Zoom, I thought, oh my gosh, he looks like Ram Dass. Well, his story is not so different. Ethan is a devotee of a woman often known as the Hugging Saint, Mata Amritanandamayi Devi. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Ama, as she's popularly known, is known for sitting up to 18 hours straight hugging people who come to her. She's involved in various outreaches and has taken up several social issues, including the importance of selfless service, the need for interreligious harmony, for environmental protection, and of the desegregating science and spirituality. She also speaks regularly on the importance of women's empowerment and gender equality, as well as that of humankind. On top of her Sevara service to humanity are the stories of miracles that surround her, stories of healing and even raising the dead. Now, my guest, Ethan, was born and grew up in Oklahoma, and in the late 60s, at the age of 19, he read Timothy Leary's interview in Playboy magazine and promptly left for the Los Angeles area to explore the psychedelic revolution. And this led to a cosmic experiences which put him on the spiritual path for the rest of his life. It's all chronicled in his book, The Mystic, A Story of Light, Love, and Spiritual Adventures. After 10 years of practicing non-duality, following the instructions of Ramana Maharishi and Nisargadatta Maharaj, he met his guru, Ama, who put him on the path of bhakti, or spiritual devotion. Many more cosmic experiences ensued at the hands of Ama. All of Ethan's books are explorations of the spiritual path, and especially bhakti, with the books Finding God's Love, Ama's Love, Bhakti Sutras and Narada, and 108 Hugs for Jesus. Now, 50 years after driving to Los Angeles to find LSD, he's focused his practice on love and the cultivation of love. These are specific daily practices to which he was directed and guided by his guru, Ama. His beloved is the Divine Mother, and he has written 3 books of devotional poetry to her: Soft Moon Shining, A Cup of Tea, and The Divine Mother of the Universe. So let's begin the interview.
Okay.
All right. So Ethan, thank you so much for being here today. I know not many of my listeners may know much about Ama. So would you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes. Ama was born in 1953, and she has she's a very, very unique saint. I've studied and read many, many saints over the years and admire many of them, you know. But Ama is, first of all, she's hugged 40 million people in the past 40 years. And that's a little less than 3,000 a day. And in India, when she tours, she hugs, you know, typically 20,000 people in a day. They come in droves in India. Not so many in the United States or Europe, there might be, you know, at a program, there might be 3,000 or 4,000 people. She'll hug them. She'll hug them all, you know. But she hugs, excuse me. She'll start hugging in the morning, maybe around 10 a.m., and she'll hug until maybe 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And she comes back and she starts hugging. They have a program around 7 and sing Bhajan. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And then she'll hug them for maybe 3 or 4 in the morning.
Wow.
And then she'll get up at 10 o'clock the next day and do it again. So it's hard to understand this hug. It's like the hug is transcendental. Many people have cosmic experiences getting this hug, myself included. But then a lot of people don't. They just, you know, they come see her and, oh, she's a nice lady. The food was good, like the music, and they don't come back, you know.
Right. How many hugs have you gotten from her?
Oh, a couple hundred, maybe.
Wow. How did this start with her? How did she start? I mean, she's known as the hugging saint.
How did she start hugging? Yeah. Well, if you reading her biography, it talks about she was from a very young age very compassionate. She would steal food from her parents' pantry and give it to poor people, and they would beat her for it. And she was, even as a young child, she would go into trance states and lose it with the divine. And she was totally enamored with Krishna, and she would dance and sing to Krishna, and eventually the Divine Mother appeared to her. Okay. And then she started doing a thing called Krishna Bhava. Bhava means mood up, where she gets into the mood of Krishna, and that's how she started hugging. And people would come and hug her, and she got so much flack when she was young. She was hated by many villagers, and she's hugging not just women, but men. And that was totally verboten, you know. That's just culturally not something you do as young girls. Right. But she's hugging everyone. Then she started doing Devi Bhava, Devi Divine Mother Bhava Mudav. She was doing both Krishna Bhava, and then she changed to Devi Bhava. She eventually stopped doing Krishna Bhava because, as she explains, Krishna is the manifestation of the formless absolute, pure silence, the void, mm-hmm. and detachment. And she said that she felt that wasn't really what people need now. What they need is love and caring and attention and compassion. And those are all attributes of the feminine, the Divine Mother. Mm-hmm. So from then on, it was just the Devi Bhava that she was doing. And so this went on for many years. I don't know. I went to see her first in 1988. So it's been over 30 years since. And then before that, there was another 10 years she was doing that in India.
Sorry to jump in there. So how did you come to, what's your spiritual journey? What did you grow up as, and how did you come to be interested in this and then taking her as your guru?
Well, that was kind of a journey. I grew up, you know, my parents were not religious, and I guess my dad, you could say he was an atheist even, but we didn't really talk about it much. But when I was in high school, I was an atheist. Mm-hmm. And that all changed one night. I had read Timothy Leary's interview in Playboy magazine about LSD, and I thought I really need to try that. So a friend of mine and I, we went to Los Angeles, and we were staying there, and we were in we had all taken LSD in this house in Pasadena, and maybe 10 people. And this friend had a copy of the I Ching. That's the Chinese Book of Changes. Mm-hmm. And he offered to explain it to us. We were saying, well, what's that? Well, I'm gonna show it to you. So three or four of us went in the kitchen and sitting cross-legged on the floor, and he's explaining the I Ching, and you throw these coins down to determine the hexagram that applies to you. And he's explaining how everything's interconnected. And that's why the coins work. and something just went off. I don't know what happened. It just was a lightning bolt. And suddenly I just saw clearly that everything in the universe was being controlled by this vast intelligence. Down to the curl of the incense smoke and the flutter of every leaf, everything was being controlled by this. And I didn't know, I thought, well, that's God, you know? And so, but I was completely blown away. And there were a couple of more experiences like that, taking psychedelics at that period. Mm-hmm. And so then I started reading Buddhist and Hindu Eastern teachings, and I thought, wow, these people are talking about what I experienced, you know. So I realized I couldn't stay high on LSD forever, and so I started that. Actually, the first organization I got into were the Rosicrucians. They're ancient mystical order of Rosicrucians. And I was fascinated with that, and I stayed with that for a couple of years. And there was a woman at the Rosicrucian Lodge who introduced me to the IM school, and guy, and I forget his wife's name, Ballard, but they were no longer alive. And then she told me about the Summit Lighthouse, which was in Colorado Springs, Mark and Elizabeth Prophet, and they were taking dictations from ascended masters. And so I actually went there and lived for several years. They called it being a staff member, by like being in a monastery. So I did that. And then I became somewhat disillusioned with that and left. And then I was studying Ramana Maharshi. I got into that, and Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I was on the non-dual path. And I was practicing self-inquiry quite extensively. I would do it most of the time. I'm driving in my car, and, you know, trying to keep my awareness on my awareness, and practicing neti-neti, not this, not that, developing discrimination. I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm not my job, I'm not my car, I'm not my relationships. And there were some experiences, there were some non-dual experiences. And then a friend of mine who I'd been in the Summit Lighthouse with, who lived in the Bay Area, he had left also. He called me and said, he'd been to India like a dozen or more times and met all these saints. And he was a follower of Ananda Mahima at that time. And he said, I've just been to see this woman in San Francisco. I think she's a real bona fide saint. You should go see her. And she's going to be in Santa Fe, which is just down the street from Oklahoma. And so a friend of mine and I, we packed up and we went to Santa Fe, and that's the first time I met her. And it was in a tent at the property owned by these people up in the mountains. And there were, the first day, there weren't that many people there. This is like the second time she's been to the United States. And in the evening, there might've been 100 people, in the morning, there may be 30. And so, the first evening, I had a note in my hand. I went up to see her, and it said, I've been following Ramana Maharshi. Do you have any suggestions for my practice? And she looked in my eyes for 5 or 6 seconds, like she's reading me. And she says, practicing non-duality without devotion is like eating stones. It's very dry and very difficult to hang with. And she suggested that I learn to cry to God. And she made it very clear. She meant not just figuratively, but to literally have tears running down your cheeks, you know, of love for the divine. Mm-hmm. So this blew my mind, because in the standard Vedanta philosophy is there are no gods, there are no goddesses, there are no others, there's no, only the self.
Self,
with a capital S. Right. So who is there to be, who is there to worship whom, you know? Of course, this is all in my intellect, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm troubled by this. And so my friend who went with me, he asked the same question. He was also into Ramana Maharshi. And she said, and my friend, I have to preface this by saying he was, bless his heart, he was a person who was never on time for anything, ever. And she told him that when he got up in the morning, he should write a list of what he was going to do that day and the time he was going to do it and follow that. She totally nailed him. I mean, so I couldn't just blow off her prescription for me as a generic thing, love God.
It wasn't just something she was passing the same advice to everyone. Yeah.
Right. So I had to at least consider it was specifically tailored, you know, to me. But I'm still confused about, you know, I've had all these years of there are no others and all that. How am I going to do this? And, mm-hmm. and when you do that practice, you look down at people who are devotional as being us kind of like second class. Right. You know, they're not really ready for the straight whiskey yet of the non-dual self, you know. So an element of pride and arrogance there, which is typical of that path. And so I came in the next morning. And I got there early. I got there like an hour early so I could get right on the front row. And she comes in and she sits down on this little platform that she had, and she's scanning the room, looking left, looking right. She looked over at me and we had eye contact. And suddenly I was looking through her eyes and I was seeing the Divine Mother of the Universe. I understood that's what it was. It was the Divine Mother of the Universe. And that Amma was just a mask that the Divine Mother had put on in order to have a conversation with us. Wow. You know, and so I was seeing also that the entire universe was created by the Divine Mother as an act of devotion, and that it was all art. It was like music, poetry. It was like, you know, this blissful being created all this and made it beautiful as an offering to the absolute self that I'd been pursuing all these years. And that they were embraced in an internal love affair, if you will, or, you know. Right. So I was completely blown away by that.
Those tears come?
Yes. Yes. And so I went home, and what she was doing was showing me how to proceed. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, how am I supposed to do this? And so this vision occurs and I see the Divine Mother and she's showing me, you know, we'll go that way. And so I go home and I, in my meditation in the morning, I would visualize a Mother Mary figure because that's what I knew most. Yeah. And with white robes and turquoise and everything. And I would try to feel love for her, simply that. And it was difficult because up until that point, love was just a four letter word for me. I didn't, you know, I didn't really have any love. I didn't experience love during the day in any day. But I would get into it by thinking back at dogs that I'd had when I was young and how much I loved them. And I would put my arms around their neck and say, "Oh, I love you so much. You know, I just love these dogs." And I could resurrect that feeling. And so it was like visualizing with your feelings, but it's love. You're trying to get this love going. And so it just starts to increase and you begin to get more and more love. So that's how Amma set me on this path.
Wow. Wow. And so just out of curiosity, how does one choose a guru? Is it that the guru always chooses you? I mean, because, you know, you were talking about Ramana, you know, Maharishi, and kind of choosing his way. And then is it always like that? Does one pick a guru? Are you with a guru for the rest of their life? How does the guru system, I guess, work for those of us in the West who aren't familiar with it?
Well, that's what the teachings far and wide say, is that the guru actually chooses you. You know, that you won't have a guru until you're ready to have one. But one important thing I should mention I left out was in my practice of non-duality, I'd had some experiences and I realized I was starting to see how enormous my ego was, and not any bigger than anyone else's, I suppose, but I could see that this attachment to an I thought, a person, was in everything. It was in all of my perceptions. It was everything revolved around this I, you know, and so it was like becoming clear, I guess you could say. And I'm thinking, holy schmoly, how am I ever going to get rid of all that? You know, it's like I've got a little bucket and a pickaxe and I'm trying to get rid of the Himalayas. And so I had become, I guess, very intent on getting rid of the ego. I could see how bad it was. You know, all of our afflictive emotions, you know, anger, pride, jealousy, attachments, all of those are all revolve around the ego. They're because of the ego. And not only that, but all wars, all genocides, all fist fights, all rudeness, all ugliness, all of that is all comes out of the ego. And so it's literally the most demonic, horrible thing that there is, period. And so with that in mind, I was thinking, how can I get rid of it, you know? And so that's when I met Amma. So it was just at that point in my life, I was, you know, I think that I met her because I was ready to get rid of the ego. And it's still there, by the way. Maybe we're making some progress.
So is it that the bhakti path, the devotional path, I believe they both paths can follow the same, you know, lead to the same truth, but is the bhakti path kind of a self-emptying of that lower self or what you call ego? It's in some ways, it's kind of like it surrenders, it lets go, and it's a practice of not just one time only. It's not, you know, ask Jesus in your heart and you're suddenly saved. It's a continual process of self-emptying so that basically you can awaken to the self, which is the divine in all things. Is that correct? Is that how you understand it?
Yes, mostly. For me, that's the path of bhakti is a surrendering, and it's also a filling of the heart with love.
Yeah, yeah.
And love is the key operator. Okay. Love is the magic sauce. Love is the most potent destroyer of the ego that there is. Right. And this it only takes common sense to see this, because the ego is about me, 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 me. And love is about you, 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 you. It's about something other than me. It's about love for God, love for nature, love for a person, love for my dog. So they're completely antithetical. They're total opposites. They don't mix like oil and water. Where there's ego, there can't be love. And where there's love, there can't be ego. Okay. So love, as Amma says, is the most potent destroyer of the ego. However, it's very difficult to find people who are interested in love or resonate with love. You talk to them about love, but they don't get it. This has been my perception. And so the path of non-duality, it has a lot of intellectual toeholds that you can grab hold of. And, you know, it's most, for most people, it's in their intellect. It's what they're, you know, but love is empty. There's nothing there. There's nothing the intellect can grasp about love. In fact, the intellect will deny it. It'll say that love is just emotionalism or whatever. So an interesting story, years ago, like 25, 30 years ago, I was sitting in a hotel, hospital waiting room. And I picked up a Christian magazine on the stand next to me. And I flipped over to the back pages and was reading the advertisements, which is a habit of mine. And there are all these Bible study classes in there that you can take. You sign up, you know, you can send off, you know, they'll send you a bunch of cassettes and a book and they would list the all the categories that they, the topics that they would cover. And so I'm reading, there's maybe a dozen Bible study classes for sale in there, and each of them maybe having a dozen topics. And I'm reading through the topics, and I couldn't find the word love a single time. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that's really odd. Because that's the foundation of the teachings of Jesus, you know. He said they asked him in the temple, what are the best of the commandments? He said, I only have two commandments for you. One is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and all your strength. Now think of how emphatic that is, that statement. All your strength, all your soul, all your heart. And the second one is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. So love is the core of what Jesus is. Love is the operative word. And here are these. Go ahead.
So with that, because this leads to my next question, you wrote a book called The Mystic Christ. And that was the book I first became aware of you about, because it was revolutionary to my thinking at that time, having come from a fundamentalist background. And you look at Jesus as almost a guru or an avatar of God, almost in the sense of Sanatana Dharma, is coming down. Did that partly prompt you to write that book? That experience of seeing, where's the love? I'm so curious.
Not exactly. What prompted me was seeing that, you know, if you looked at all of these sayings of Jesus, it really was Hinduism and Buddhism. They were all saying the same thing. But the things that Jesus was saying, like the kingdom of God is within you, Luke 17:21, you know, that's not emphasized. You won't hear any talks and sermons on the kingdom of God is within you, you know. So those things are glossed over. But the love thing is apparent, you know. It really surprised me. And to this day, you can go online and do a search for Bible study classes. And I do it every once in a while. Looking through the first four that come up, again, the word love doesn't occur. The word love isn't there. And that should be, if you're a Christian, you should be saying, well, these are, he says these are commandments. How do I do this? What is it? You know, what does it mean to love God with that kind of intensity? Are there symptoms? How do I know I'm in the zone there? And if I'm not, which most of us are not, how do I cultivate that? The most important thing, how do I cultivate that kind of love? It has to be cultivated. It's not just going to happen. And so that's what, you know, in my mind, that people should be talking about most if they're Christians.
Do you consider yourself a devotee of Jesus?
I love Jesus very much. But, you know, Amma's my guru.
Right.
But I love Jesus, you know, so probably more than any other saint.
Right. And it's very neat now within some of the more mystical Christian and some Anglican now, the centering prayer, they call it the wisdom tradition. They're actually talking about non-duality in there now. And and that Jesus, you know, what Paul describes Jesus as the wisdom of God made flesh. And of course, wisdom in Hebrew is Sophia, the divine feminine made flesh. And I was like, okay, maybe an avatar, the mother here. And I was like, it's wild where this could go. Yeah.
Well, Amma is very much like Jesus. That both of them are very out front with love. That's the main thing that they teach. Amma says, my religion is love.
Tell me, I know she's involved in many different charities and many different works. What are some of those that listeners might be interested in?
Oh, they're just vast. In two hospitals, large hospitals, specialty hospitals, and they give, it's for pay if you have the money, but if you don't, it's free. In building houses for homeless, like last count, it was 100,000 homes have been built for homeless people. And of course, providing food for people, pensions for widowers, programs to go into the bush and help these tribal villages that are way back out in the middle of nowhere, install running water, water wells and solar panels. And it just goes on and on and on and on. The charities are just vast. And that's another aspect of Amma, what makes her great. And another thing,
not accruing 42 Rolls Royce and lives in a big mansion and rides a
no, nothing like that. She lives very modestly in this very small room that's like 200 square feet and has very few personal, you know, clothes or anything like that. So another thing that she does is she gives out these spiritual experiences, like somebody passing out candy. It's like many people, I would guess 100,000, I don't know, you know, maybe more, have these cosmic visions and insights. And when they go see Amma, when they get hugged by her, just like the first time I went to see her and I looked through her eyes and I saw the Divine Mother. You know, this is another thing that's very unusual, for to hug. She hugs all comers, and if people are open to it, they'll have an experience. And that's very, and there's really nobody, saints from the past or whoever, that has done so much for so many people in such a short amount of time, which is an outpouring of compassion. That's our compassion. And what would motivate someone to hug, you know, 40 million people over 40 years? What's behind that? Why would someone do that? Why would she hug so many hours and stay up to 3 or 4 in the morning? And it's love. It's love and it's compassion. But it's a compassion and love that's so vast and so big that we can't even comprehend it. We just see her doing this and we think, oh my gosh, this is just, you know, superhuman. And the motivation to do this is a love like we've never seen before.
If so, you know, say one of the listeners begins to read about her, read her writings, or listen to talks, and they wanted to become her student, what is the process of taking her as their guru, I guess, or is there a process, or is it just simply?
There's no process.
Okay.
Yeah. There's no process. There are people who live at the ashram that are renunciates, you know, and nuns. And of course they ask, you know, can I move here and become a monk? And she'll say yes or no. But for most everybody, there's no process. You can get a mantra from her. It's not a requirement, but of course, if you like Amma, you're going to do that. So you get a mantra and you say the mantra and you study her life, you study her teachings, and you try to go forward with that. And if you have the opportunity to go see her and sit in her presence, and that's a definitely a plus.
So you've written a couple of books, devotional poetry to the mother, to the Divine Mother. One of them, I know that it's close to my heart, Soft Moon Shining. Who is the Divine Mother in Sanatana Dharma? How do you understand her?
Well, for me personally, it goes back to that very first experience sitting cross-legged on the floor in Pasadena, looking at the I Ching and going, oh my gosh, this is it. And that was the Divine Mother that I was seeing. It was this vast intelligence that inhabits everything and controls everything. So I didn't call it the Divine Mother back then, but now later, you know, I look back at that and I think that's the Divine Mother. Divine Mother is a universal, all-pervading intelligence that inhabits all things. It's the Divine Mother that creates the universe, maintains the universe, dissolves the universe, and then causes it to be reborn again. And this has been going on without beginning or end. There's no beginning or end to form. In other words, form is, yes, constantly changing, but it's eternal. It's not something that, and it's the flip side of Brahman or the silence or the absolute self. You know, the two really are one thing, and they're not separate.
So how many books have you written?
I think it's 22 or 23.
Wow. Are there any new books in the works?
No. I'm right now I'm working on making audible books.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And recording. I recorded Death of the Ego and got it up online. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm doing Conversations with the Divine Mother of the Universe, which is a more recent book.
Okay.
So it keeps me off the streets and out of trouble.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, I just want to thank you so much, Ethan, for taking time. We spoke, gosh, I don't know how many years ago. I mean, I lived in Enid, so I'm trying to think how many years that's been. It may be 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And here kind of circles back around to still in love with her, because you were back then. I read The Mystic Christ, and I think I wrote you an email or something that we spoke just very briefly. And back around. Is there any last things you'd want to say to listeners?
Keep love alive.
Keep love alive. Keep love.
Yeah. Well, hold on to love. Pursue love. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ethan, thank you so much. Please enjoy the rest of your day and your weekend.
Okay, Jay. And Thank you. It's been fun. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you want to continue listening, please consider joining our Patreon or visiting us on Facebook. Until next time, this is Pax.